Hello, I'm Catherine Jansen, editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. As always, I'm delighted to welcome you to Speculum Spotlight, a collaboration with the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Ordinarily, each episode brings you behind the scenes of one article published in our current issue, but in the case of our April 2024 issue, a themed collection entitled Race, Race Thinking, and Identity in the Global Middle Ages, we're doing something a bit different. Jonathan Correa-Reyes, our host from the Department of English at Clemson University, opens this episode with a far-reaching conversation with our guest editors, Cord Whitaker of Wellesley College, Nahir Otaña Gracia of the University of New Mexico, and François-Xavier Fauvel of the Collège de France in Paris and the French Research Center in Jerusalem. Cord Whitaker is the author of Black Metaphors, How Modern Racism Emerged from Medieval Race Thinking, winner of the John Nicholas Brown Prize from the Medieval Academy of America in 2023. He is also a founding member of the Medievalists of Color and the Race Before Race Collectives, and he is working on two new books, one on Black American medievalism in the Harlem Renaissance, and another on Black American resistance strategies and their utility for fighting the global rise in far-right fascism. Nahir Otaña Gracia has published a number of articles on literature from the global North Atlantic, including Towards a Decentered Global North Atlantic, winner of the MAA's Article Prize in Critical Race Studies, her co-edited volume of essays, Women's Lives, Self-Representation, Reception, and Appropriation in the Middle Ages, was published in 2023, and she's currently working on a monograph entitled The Other Faces of Arthur, Chivalric Whiteness in the Global North Atlantic. FX Fauvel is a widely published author on medieval Africa with about 20 books and 150 articles and chapters to his credit, most notably in English, The Golden Rhinoceros, Histories of the African Middle Ages. He's worked extensively in Ethiopia and Morocco, and for many years has been advocating to put Africa on the map of the Middle Ages. Let's now turn the conversation over to John, Cord, Nahir, and FX.
Thanks, Kate. Cord, Nahir, FX, let me officially welcome you to this Speculum Spotlight episode. Let's jump right in.
The word race often seems to elicit strong responses. Even today, studies about race in medieval history and culture are described as anachronistic or accused of projecting a modern category of identity, that of race, onto the medieval past. Why do you think it is vital to acknowledge the longer histories of race and race thinking, histories that do not skip what we both conveniently and problematically call the Middle Ages? Cord, maybe you can start us off.
I will happily. The perceived anachronism of discussing race in the Middle Ages is very much a function of the European nation states as global powers. For many reasons, but one of the reasons that I like to turn to most often is the notion of chivalry, chivalric honor. When that notion is deployed to underwrite the history of empowerment, the history of sovereignty, the history of grasping power over other cultures and peoples, both externally and internally. The Middle Ages has, for a very long time, since the 16th and 17th centuries, since people even started thinking of it as the Middle Ages, it's been seen as that period in which the sort of purity, the ethics, the rectitude, the rightness of England, of France, of Germany, but also of Spain, right? The notion that your nation state has the right to control other places in the world and has the right to claim perpetuity in and of itself goes back to this idea that, you know, what you're starting out from is pure and honorable. And so for that reason, the Middle Ages has long been cast, but especially in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, especially once we get into the height of European colonialism, the Middle Ages has been cast as this place of purity and innocence. Purity and innocence has no place for the kinds of power negotiations and for, at times, the brutality as well that's involved in the development of race. Race-making brings along things that simply are not pretty for claiming a kind of divine right to power. There's no place for race-making in a Middle Ages that is innocent and beautiful and ethical and serves as the argument for the sovereignty and the power and the honor and the greatness of the European nation states that would become colonial powers by the 18th and 19th centuries. So the Middle Ages must be kept what I call racially innocent in order to preserve the argument for the power of the European nation state.
At least for me as a scholar of literature, one of the things that we do is define, but also name the things that we study, right? And so if we have vocabulary to talk about difference and power, why should we not use it? And I think that for me, race and critical race studies and these sort of theoretical frameworks get at what I see in the literature when I am studying. I look at multiple texts in different languages and I find that race as a framework gets at the most important parts of what I'm seeing in these texts. Why should we be told that there's vocabularies or words of ideas that are not allowable to describe what is there? Because it goes against our own ideologies as scholars.
I completely agree with what Cord and Nair just said. I mean, I like very much Cord's idea of a Middle Ages that is often perceived as a pure, unmixed, innocent period before the great encounter of European power discovering the others, and before this ugly modern period that supposedly invented race. But no, it always was there, and we just forgot it. Plus, I would say exactly like Nair, as a historian, I have absolutely no problem with anachronism. And contrary to what most people think and what most students are taught, using current words and analytical categories to analyze societies in the past is exactly what we are doing. And this is exactly what the job of being a historian is about. And not the least because it consists in translating a past reality into a present reality. And we cannot do it in the terms of the past society. That would be meaningless and useless. So yes, let's use the word that we have at our disposal to analyze the past. And race is one of these very useful words.
Yep. I'd like to pick up on what FX just said, because I think that when people criticize pre-modern critical race studies as anachronistic, one assumption they're laboring under is that as scholars, our goal is always to be completely objective observers, that we're just objective empiricists, right? Fortunately, I think even scholarship over the past several decades has shown the extent to which that's a cultural fantasy. Because we're humans, our goal as scholars, as literary scholars, as historians, but I'd even bring in as anthropologists, as sociologists, and so forth, our goal is to examine nuance. Our goal is to be able to bring nuance and different discourses and different evidences into conversation, to judge them against one another, to understand the networks that they're working in. That's our goal. That's what we train to do. I don't think we ever will, nor should we, be completely objective. To study a field like the Middle Ages, to study a period that's different than one's own, it necessarily involves some affective relationship Right. It necessarily involves love for your subject, hate for your subject, some kind of reaction to it. At my best, there are moments when I'm really working with the text where I do have methods almost to try to inhabit the text a little bit and to use what I know of 14th century readers and readership practices to try to be a little bit of a 14th century reader. But I'll never completely be a 14th century reader because I'm a 21st century black man in the United States. I'm a 21st century human being. Right. And so my experiences necessarily shape how I read. I mean, you know, one of my favorite people to ever say that, I think very clearly, C.S. Lewis said that everything we read shapes everything we write. And it also shapes everything else we read. And so I think that we do the most honest scholarship when we recognize that and seek to put it in the most illuminating conversations with the way other people are reading, but not to try to say, yeah, well, because the concept of race as it's constituted in 2024 did not exist in 1381. Because by that same argument, then we could also argue that, well, since the concept of race in 2024 isn't the same or understood the same way as people would have understood it in 1965, then we shouldn't use race to talk about 1965. And such a statement would be categorically laughable.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I completely agree. Actually, that would be anachronistic. Pretending that the meaning of words have not changed through times would make us some sort of originalist in our job, and that would be completely anachronistic.
I really like that the conversation is going in this direction, which leads me to my next question. As you have all hinted at, we cannot leave our experiences at the door before showing up to work. Case in point, you opened the introduction to the issue quite forcefully with personal anecdotes. Cord and Nair, you juxtapose your experiences as a black man and as a Puerto Rican woman of color working in medieval studies to FX's experience as a white man from France working on African history. Could you talk to us about why you think it's important to lead with these personal narratives? Cord?
Because the development of race and therefore the study of race are utterly interdisciplinary. Certainly once we get into modernity and race becoming not just a set of loosely connected discourses, but becoming, you know, once we move through the racial sciences and it becomes a hegemonic ideology that touches pretty much every aspect of many individuals' lives. Narratives about the editors or the authors' experience as raced beings allows in the recognition of the multitude of elements of one's experience that are affected by race. So you're setting a kind of container for the study. By telling a bit of story about the lives of the people involved in making this container, in making this scholarship, you do open up for the reader just how vast the set of experiences are that influence the analysis that follows.
I work at the University of New Mexico, which I'm very proud of. We are mostly students of color. We are almost 50% first generation. And so my students struggle a lot with whether they belong at the institution, right? And so one of the things I tell them, and I think it's very important to this, is that I separate the ideas of expertise and knowledge. And so I tell them, I am teaching you expertise because I am an expert. I have a PhD in comparative literature. I've published about literature in multiple languages. This is why I'm here. But the fact that I'm Puerto Rican, that I'm a woman, that I'm hispanohablante, that I'm not a native speaker of English working in an English department, that I am a medievalist in a field that's mostly white. These ideas gives me knowledge, and it is my expertise and my knowledge combined that makes me really good at my job. And it is their knowledge that they bring with the expertise that I'm teaching them that is going to make them excellent scholars. I am teaching them expertise, but their knowledge is what's going to help them create new expertise. For me, this introduction is admitting that we bring not just an expertise, but a knowledge into creating scholarship. And we need that. And I think that our students more and more need that from us. Cord wrote his first, and when I saw it, I was so happy that he started us this way. And when I read FX's, I was also incredibly happy because it showed three different ways of bringing knowledge that create what I think is an introduction about expertise.
It's about not pretending to be neutral. And you're right, our expertise as medievalists cannot be disentangled from our experience and your various trajectories that converged toward the same topic. And in this regard, I found it very interesting to have to say something about my personal, let's say, racial relationship with the topic. That was the first time in my life that I had as a white man. And that's very interesting because nowhere should it be considered a given that a white man is more entitled than anyone else to study the Middle Ages. And for the same reason, than should white American supremacist should be granted that the Middle Ages belong to him. And what did I have to say? Well, that I am a white French person who became a medievalist of Africa. And what does it do to my way of being a historian, to be an expert of the African Middle Ages? Well, the major avenue to get to the African societies south of the Sahara is mostly through Arabic sources. And that means sources written in Arabic by people who were alien to these societies, who visited these societies, or we describe these societies from abroad, from North Africa in some cases, but most of the time from the central land of Islam, what is today Iraq, for instance, or Egypt. That means that the main bulk of the documents that we have about sub-Saharan African societies is always mixed with biases, with very strong preconceptions, with a number of assumptions about skin color, about physiognomy, about assumed mental capacities, about, of course, geographical location, religion, ethnic identities, language, social status. And all this always intersects in ways that are so reminiscent to the present. You know? And it's never clear-cut. Sometimes religion is enough to change the perceived skin color of someone. All this means what? All this means that race is always about intersection. These racial biases, this intersection between race and all other aspects, all this speaks about race being present even though the word is not in the societies that we're talking about.
To continue our conversation, it seems to me that you were very intentional in choosing what voices to support for this themed issue. Most, if not all, of the contributors to the issue seem to be emerging scholars. I imagine you received submissions from scholars across all ranks. So why did you choose to support these voices? And can you talk to us about your approach to help them prepare their essays?
Because we want to shape the medieval studies of tomorrow. to be quite frank about it. But in all seriousness, the study of race in the Middle Ages, which has been going on in various forms for decades, well before Margot Hendricks coined the term pre-modern critical race studies, well before, because that's only 5 years ago. But because it's been so contested, a lot of scholars who've been around longer are influenced by different periods in its acceptance, as well as different ways in which people have argued against it over the past several decades. So one thing I noticed, and Nair and FX might disagree with me on this, but one thing I noticed is that in some of the proposals, some really interesting proposals, sometimes they were arguing against the detractors of 15 years ago, or 5 years ago, or 20 years ago. The history of the development of the field was encoded in some of the proposals. And that's really great and exciting, and it's an approach. We could do another themed issue that has 40 essays that try to trace the variety of arguments for and against pre-modern critical race studies over the past 50 years. Maybe that's our next project. but it might be too soon. But what we ultimately settled on was these voices that we think really represented where we in pre-modern critical race studies are now.
There's a way in which we're talking about branches within pre-modern critical race studies. These essays are not just looking at one thing. They're taking pre-modern critical race studies into different areas, from food studies and gender and sexuality to whiteness. They are taking us in different places. We're branching out. And I think that this special issue, it's a really great place to see where these branches are going. I always felt this way about, for example, feminism, right? Like, we need multiple types of feminisms. And similarly, we need multiple ways of understanding race. To keep the metaphor going, I want to see a very robust tree. I want to see this big tree with lots of branches that gives space for multiple voices. The more, the merrier.
The result that we have with this issue mirrors the way we worked together. Always the question was, okay, what is the more exciting there? And what is the more exciting topic? What is the more exciting approach? That made actually our job very exciting too during these almost 3 years, you know, of work.
I want to say one thing, our process. I think Cord and I called it the rigor of care. We wanted these essays to be as excellent as they could be. And we worked very hard to make sure that they met first our expectations of what these essays needed to do, and then that they met the reviewers' expectations. Some of these essays, we asked for revisions multiple times, and our writers, they did it. And I'm really proud about that, because it was about making the work better. I think FX is absolutely right. We chose the exciting work, but then we also made sure that it met with the most top-notch standards, and we worked very hard, and the writers worked very hard to get those standards where we wanted them. And it taught me that that's possible, right? We do the work to make sure that these writers get published and published good work. As editors, we can do that. And I was really proud of that.
We were working with authors to make the essays as strong as possible, according to our judgments, according to the judgments of reviewers, but also up to the standards of speculum. To do this work also required rethinking what it means to be the journal that's a standard bearer for an entire field. What does it mean to be the gold standard journal? What does it mean to produce, to publish the best scholarship in a field? And I think in the past, that has meant that it appears to be objectivist, empiricist, and utterly scientific. Right. But that doesn't fly with the work we're doing. So instead, it really had to become about giving the closest attention to the nuances of your evidence, to the places where your evidence speaks back to itself, where it's not consistent, where it appears to be registering multiple discourses at once. Taking all that into account in a way that's responsible to the evidence. And then on top of that, conveying that as a writer, conveying it in a way where that is legible to your reader, where your reader is able to see, and by the end of the work, where they're able to see the ways that the evidence is pushing back against itself and drawing from here and drawing from there, and the ways that the evidence itself is troubling and unsettled and self-challenging. And to do that well as a writer, to do it readably as a writer, is not easy. That is hard work. I think we as editors saw as our charge to help writers bring their work to that level. And by George, I think we've done it. I think we've done it. And I'm pretty damn excited that I think we've done it.
And rightly so.
Yeah. The rigor of care wasn't only for our writers, and it wasn't only for the text and the scholarship. The rigor of care was also among us as human beings practicing in this field, I just think it's worth saying, when you're working on a project for 3 years, life happens. And I think all three of us here have experienced a lot of life over the past 3 years. And at times our work's even been disrupted by matters of global import. It's not possible to see some of the horrors that have gone on in the world over the past few years without being affected by them. FX has been deeply involved in some of the recovery work in Israel and Gaza. And that work is incredibly important to our world. And we're thankful to him for doing it and for others who are also doing it. And that's also, you know, it's also work that's related to the kind of historical recovery work we're doing here in this issue. I think it's really easy to think that there's a difference in magnitude between working directly with people whose lives have been affected by the events of the past several months and working with the evidence of people whose lives were affected by things that went on 700 years ago. But when it comes down to it, in the grand scheme of things, part of our rhetoric of care has been for humanity, both humans who are here now, humans who were here up until very recently, and humans who were here living life and experiencing traumas and negotiating one another and figuring out what they wanted their world to be 700 years ago too.
What a beautiful note to end on, the importance of care. I'll take this opportunity to thank you for all your work on this themed issue and beyond. Thank you, Cord, Nair, FX, for all the care and generosity you are bringing to our fields of study.
What a wonderful conversation that lays the groundwork so well for our contributing authors now to encapsulate their work. Let me introduce them briefly. Dr. Ty Catherine Matthews has recently defended her PhD dissertation at the Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Annegret Ohme is Associate Professor in the Department of German Studies at the University of Washington. Basil Arnold Price is a Humanities Research Center Doctoral Fellow and a Wolfson Scholar at the Center for Medieval Studies at the University of York. Dr. Angela Zhang is a Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of History at Harvard University. Eduardo Ramos is a postdoctoral research scholar at Arizona State University. Susong Cho is a PhD candidate in the Department of English at the City University of New York Graduate Center. And Christina Ilko is a junior research fellow at Queen's College at the University of Cambridge.
Thanks again, Kate. I sat down with the 7 contributors and asked them to speak about their essays, as well as to the importance of mapping the longer histories of race, race thinking, and identity in the global Middle Ages. I hope that these brief clips will help generate excitement and support for their important work. To follow the table of contents of the issue, maybe we can start with Ty Catherine Matthews. Ty Catherine, could you talk to us a little bit about your essay?
So my article is entitled On the Margins of Allah, Feminist Theologies of Enclosure in Julian of Norwich and Harriet Jacobs. And the critical argument is actually embarrassingly simple. I had read Harriet Jacobs as a high school student and as an African-American and as an African-American from the South. Her story was really, really important to me and it stuck with me. She's a woman who escapes enslavement by actually fleeing to this enclosed space on her free grandmother's property in the middle of small town North Carolina in the 1830s. So that story stuck with me as a high school student. I grew up, became a medievalist, and encountered Julian of Norwich. And the idea that she sort of escapes the expectations of a typical medieval woman from the higher classes by going into enclosure as an anchoress and producing what ends up being the first woman-authored work of theology in the English language. When it came time for me to write my dissertation, I couldn't stop thinking about how these two stories seem to echo each other and seem to align, not because Harriet Jacobs as this sort of self-emancipated enslaved woman and Julian of Norwich as this medieval anchorite, not because they were facing the same oppressions, but because they both seem to escape their different oppressions in the same way by thinking of enclosure and escaping to enclosure and writing about God and Christianity and religion in a way that seemed to justify their female freedoms and redefine who they were as women and as female theologians. And I just thought to myself, why have we not read them together before? Where is this thread that I'm seeing? Why haven't I seen that in literature? So that sort of began my journey. And that is the main thrust of my article, is that these two women, we should be reading them together. And we should be thinking about the antebellum South as an echo of medieval Europe. I have always been fascinated by medieval literature precisely because it's a time and a place and a space that predates, you know, the Atlantic slave trade. And again, I think I've spoken about this as an African-American whose deep roots in the South, enslavement and the slave trade has always been a critical part of thinking about identity. So when I became an English major in college and, you know, had to fulfill my pre-1800 requirement, I took this class where suddenly representations of ethnic and even religious and racial difference were showing up in a way that had not yet been impacted by that. And I was fascinated. I wanted to see what were these representations of the racial, religious, ethnic, even gendered other that had not been shaped by these movements of oppressions and hierarchy that had shaped my own identity. And so when I began to think about what kind of mark I wanted to leave in the field, I had to think about what are the ways in which we're going to change the narrative that hierarchies are in any way natural or unavoidable? And medieval literature seemed like the perfect place for me to do that. So I began to think about this as a space where otherness is much more complex than modern literature and modern research has sort of approached it. And so going back to, I think, the original literature, that was really what empowered me to think that we can take on these sources in a different way, that we can see them in a way that hasn't been shaped by the scholars that were themselves shaped by the imperial thrust, by colonialism, by race and gender in the way that we think about them. If we could get beyond that, if we could get past that, and here I should sort of, you know, raise my hand and say that I also studied Victorian literature. And if we can get past the scholars that created what we think of as the medieval in that 19th century time, then we can get back to the root of this literature that actually sees otherness and difference in a range of beautiful and complex and disturbing, but also optimistic ways. When I think about the long history of critical race and race thinking in the medieval studies, it really is to me about recovering, not necessarily inserting. We think about diversity as something that we do. It's newfangled and it's modern and it's something that we do to, you know, create inclusivity. And for me, thinking about diversity in the Middle Ages isn't about insertion. It really is about recovering this multiculturalism that was just a daily part. You've got manuscripts that are created in one place and then copied in another place. And you've got scribes that are then commenting in different languages. What is that except otherness on a page and diversity? I definitely think that when we talk about the Middle Ages, there is a really strong contemporary strain to that study and to that sort of basis of knowledge that we need to acknowledge. I'm hesitant to bring this up, but it's my starting point. People say, oh, hey, why do you study the Middle Ages? I tend to go back to Charlottesville in Virginia in 17. And it began, right, as this idea of American history. We're going to talk about why, you know, people came to Charlottesville, Virginia to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee, who, of course, you know, was the highest ranking general of the Confederate movement during the Civil War. And then anti-protesters who said, no, we should completely be removing this statue. They flocked to Charlottesville as well. So it became this sort of standoff between what do we think of as American history and who do we get to credit with creating the modern South? Okay, all very interesting questions. All something that you think would be very much bound up in the 19th century, except it turns out that people who were anti the removal of the statue, so pro-General Lee, pro-Confederacy thinking, they brought with them these symbols and these sigils and these flags and these images that were all very heavily medieval in their construction. And I was thinking about that because I had just started graduate school when that happened. And it never really left me because it seems very pressing to me that the medieval is the way that we continue to articulate racism and patriarchy and xenophobia. We continue to do that, and the medieval continues to be our vocabulary through which we do that. So when I think about, you know, the continued history of race thinking or how we move medieval studies forward, it's important to me that we just address that, that we call a spade, and we say, you know, the medieval has been used in this way. So going again, going back to the 19th century, going back to the imperial revival of Arthurianism, it's been used in this way. How do we think about it, articulate it, perhaps use it in another way? You can't call yourself a medieval scholar and not be willing, I think, to face off with these dangerous rhetorics that are themselves ill-informed. I think I'll just return to Charlottesville really quickly. There's a Twitter account that got a lot of play in thinking about the medieval, and I think it's called Medieval POC. And they were talking about St. Maurice. His sigil is one of the things that showed up at Charlottesville. And he's actually one of the first canonized Black saints. And there are statues of him all over, you know, the modern day Holy Roman Empire. And they're like, okay, wait, how can you then use this symbol to articulate all the reasons you believe in white supremacy? And yet you have no idea where this symbol comes from. That's where it falls to medieval scholars to defend the field, I think, from the dangerous co-opting, and I think to make it possible for us to use academia in a way that makes the world more equitable.
The next author featured in this issue is Anne-Grete Ohme. Anne-Grete, could you talk to us about your article, Lucifer's Shadow, Racial Divides in the Yiddish Bovo Dantona?
Yeah, thank you so much. Yes, in my paper, I focus on the Old Yiddish Bovebuch by Elia Levita from 1507. It's printed in 1541. And it's based on this large medieval tradition with roots in an Anglo-Norman story that usually goes or focuses on this Sir Bevis who fights against Muslims, or sometimes they're named very problematically Saracens, or in a German context, often heathens, which is a very loose term for a large group of not even Muslims, but people who follow cultural religious practices that are not seen as positive by the Christians. So the Yiddish book does something really interesting with this tradition. It makes these quotation mark heathens look even more demonic. It enhances their portray as more plague, more monstrous, in contrast to the explicit white hero Bovo. And Bovo, in addition to that, is actually explicitly Jewish in the text. So this author creates a text that aids the construction of Jewish whiteness in Central Europe, which is really interesting because Jews, of course, have been often racialized and portrayed as visibly different. And so the author appropriates racial thinking of the Christian majority, those who are in power, and draws on these anti-Muslim and anti-stereotypes to really create this like white Jewish identity long before we usually have the discussions in America. My paper really shows how race is sort of a construct that's used as a tool differently for different contexts, and how really, you know, even minorities sort of piggyback on overall stereotypes in order to benefit or sort of to fight against their own status.
Now I have the pleasure to turn to my friend Basil Arnold Price. Basil, could you talk to us about your article, Queer Indigenous Relationality in Finnboja Saga Rauma?
Thank you. So my essay focuses on an understudied Icelandic saga called Finnboja Saga Rauma, and thinks about the presence and erasure of indigeneity within this text. My central argument is that the fleeting glimpses that we get of indigeneity make possible queer desire. But that queer desire isn't an authentic representation or desire for intimacy with indigeneity. It's not a aim for what Jody Bird describes as a queer indigenous relationality. It's a queer indigenous relationality that ends up serving and confirming Norse sovereignty. So when I look at indigeneity in this text, I'm really thinking about the ways in which indigeneity serves a particular Norse kind of sovereign voice, the ways in which Old Norse narratives use intimacy with specifically Saumi figures, the indigenous people of Saupmi, to confirm and construct Norse possessive subjectivity. That's the overarching argument, and I look at it by focusing on two figures in particular, Dreimafinni or Dreamfinner, who is explicitly stated to be indigenous, and I also look at the titular Finnboji, who exchanges names with the protagonist, Ulfrekotr, who is not explicitly said to be indigenous, but his name glimpses the possibility of indigeneity, and actually later redactions of the manuscript refer to him as Finskr, as Saumi. Something that I'm trying to do or trying to think a little bit about is, in what way do medieval texts help us think about the relationship between queer studies, indigenous studies, and medieval studies? Something that I'm also trying to suggest in this particular text, and also about Old Norse literature and Saumi studies and Old Norse studies and pre-modern critical race studies, is that interactions with racialized characters in Old Norse Icelandic narratives, no matter how minor, and sometimes it's really minor, may speak to this kind of contradictory position that these characters operate in these texts, as simultaneously moments that gesture towards this multiculturalism or cosmopolitanism that can exist in these texts, but also inequalities and inequities. And I think that sometimes in our desire to acknowledge and celebrate and marvel at the wonderful and rich diversity of the Middle Ages, we sometimes neglect that there is a lot of, as I describe in this article, intimate inequity, moments where desire manifests in ways that are really detrimental and harmful and come at the expense of those who are deemed expendable. And that's something I really focus on in this article, is thinking about the ways in which racialized characters are appropriated and instrumentalized within the non-Indigenous imagination in order to affirm those sovereign subjectivities. I don't think we should read Finnboja Saga Rama actually at all as a multicultural text. I think it's a very settler text that is really trying to reinforce its own self through its mobilization of characters who are coded or are Indigenous. I think something that's really helpful about Indigenous studies is that it helps us diagnose or think about, identify the ways in which Old Norse narratives are operating within a kind of settler colonial perspective, the ways in which they advance settler ideologies, that even in contexts where there aren't Indigenous people, we are reading Old Norse texts that are written in Iceland, which does not have an Indigenous population. And it's really interesting to see how settler colonial logics can move across different borders and how kind of insidious and pernicious they are. I think particularly Indigenous perspectives on Old Norse literature help us correct a presumption that still persists within Old Norse studies that is reluctant to make use of Indigenous theory because of a perception that the Saumi are not Indigenous enough, in scare quotes. I think this helps us rethink our assumptions about who gets to be included when we talk about race in the Middle Ages. I think it also is important to think about race and the Middle Ages more generally, because I think what pre-modern critical race studies does is it complicates that story and might provide us with strategies for thinking about our very, very complex present. The ways in which race is continuously made, it's not solid, it's historically contingent, it's negotiable. It reveals that race isn't real, by which I mean race is not essential. It's made. It's this thing that's real in terms of the ways in which it's socially mandated and historically contingent, the way it's sedimented, but there's nothing essential about race and there's nothing essential about racism.
Another important contribution to the issue is by Angela Zhang. Her essay is titled Rethinking Domestic Enemies, Slavery and Race Formation in Late Medieval Florence. Angela, can you share a little bit about your essay?
So my essay sort of is in two parts. So first, it's a response to a very famous 1955 speculum essay done by Iris Rorigo called Domestic Enemies. And it's about slavery in pre-modern Tuscany as well. And this is a really groundbreaking article because it kind of foregrounds slavery in those periods in a way that no one has ever talked about before in the English-speaking world. But it was published in 1955. So I think a part of my article is to address, one, that we need to update the scholarship, and two, we need to also incorporate race and critical race theory into the scholarship. So The two parts also is to kind of retrieve the lived experiences of enslaved women in pre-modern and early modern Florence. It's really important that Florence, even though it's, you know, motto was Libertas and really celebrates the civic identity, it's really important to me to remember that they also had slaves, and a lot of their civic identity, I argue, is based on mirroring what they saw in how their slaves were treated, how they justified slavery, who was able to be enslaved. And then the second goal is just to show how critical race theory can and should be applied to archival documents. In the work that I do, I want to bridge this gap between the medieval slave trade and the early modern slave trade. I don't think the Portuguese sailed down the coast of Africa and saw West Africans and were like, let's enslave them out of nowhere. This comes from a long tradition of colorism, of enslaving the other, of trying to prove Europe's imperial and cultural hegemony in a lot of ways. It's really important to really focus on the late Middle Ages and kind of going into the early modern period, because we don't have that bridge.
The next essay in the issue is titled Imagined Invasions, Muslim Vikings in Lachmann's Brut and Middle English Romances by my good friend Eduardo Ramos. Eduardo, can you talk to us about your article?
So my essay interrogates the literary legacy of responses to the invasions of England by Scandinavians during the, let's say, 9th through 11th century. In the Middle English literature that follows, in its depictions of non-Christians. I'm particularly interested in how responses to quote-unquote Viking incursions influence depictions of Muslims who were not invading England at all. In this study, I center Lachmann's Brut, which is an early Middle English chronicle, as a critical text in the development of depictions of non-Christians in Middle English literature. And it's a fantastic text to work with because it depicts Germanic pagans as well as Muslims. And one of the things that I try to draw attention to is that while the actions of both the Saxon pagans and the Muslims are modeled on the historical activities of Scandinavians, the Germanic Saxons, as we understand in the narrative of the Brut, will eventually Christianize and become the English, just as during the historical attacks by Scandinavians, many of them were allowed to convert to Christianity and were integrated into English society, something that the text denies the possibility for Muslims. So the Muslim quote-unquote villains of Lachmann's Brut are not presented as having the ability to also eventually convert and be integrated into this broader Christian society, this North Sea empire that the legendary King Arthur has founded. So one of the things that I hope people can take away from my essay is that certain tropes and materials that are used to persecute one group can be recycled and adapted to persecute another group. Something that I touch on in the essay is there's this old English literature a phrase that's used sometimes when they're speaking of non-Christians, which is heathen hounds. We have the dehumanizing element of calling them animals, hounds, dogs in this case. And, you know, alliteration was a big deal in Old English verse. So you have heathen, which marks them as non-Christian, heathen hounds. There it is. Perfect, beautifully packaged. This is a phrase that shows up a lot in Middle English texts when speaking of not exclusively Muslims, but non-Christians more broadly. And, you know, in a text like Lachmann's Brut, that makes perfect sense. It relies heavily on alliteration for its poetry, but it's no longer just applied to quote-unquote heathens of the north. Now we also see it applied to Muslims. They're also called heathen hounds. So we see how this trope can kind of be recycled. And then we see it pop up again in a text like the romance King Horn, which is a rhyming poem. So we don't need that alliteration. But the alliterative phrase heathen hound still pops up there. And that shows us that, you know, this is in the air, kind of. These tropes that develop to mark a non-Christian enemy, they're available and people will draw them. They don't care if the enemy changes. Okay, Scandinavians aren't that bad anymore because they're Christian now and some of them participate in the crusade. Great. But we still have a non-Christian enemy, this time Muslims. And we can repackage the material that we used against the previous one on a new one. And this is something that, of course, goes beyond issues of racialization. It goes far beyond just a few literary tropes. We often see how those in power will recycle material that they want to use against those they're trying to subjugate. If they've already have a ready arsenal, they don't reinvent the wheel. They adapt their material against a new enemy. I think it's really important to consider longer histories of race because they make certain materials more visible and easy to spot than in our contemporary moment sometimes. So when you look at a longer history of race, you can see that race is not operating the same way in all places at all times. A lot of the categories and constructions of medieval race differ significantly from those of, let's say, 21st century United States. And being able to consider that longer history shows us how race changes, how it is adapted, and shows us that there is nothing inherent about the racial categories of the 21st century US. It helps us understand that these are constructions. It helps us see how these constructions can be modified over time. So in Scripts of Blackness, Noemi Andia talks about race as a matrix, and we can see how that matrix is shifting. New elements are added, some are removed, things are tweaked and adjusted to always serve the purposes of those in power. Race is about power. And taking a look at a longer history of race lets you see how those in power are able to recreate, invent, alter these models. There's nothing inherent about them. They're not fixed. They're not static. And that becomes more visible when we consider a longer period in different cultural contexts, historical and geographical.
Next up is Susan Cho. Susan, could you talk to us about your article, Food, Contamination, and Race Thinking, Culinary Encounters in Late Medieval Missionary Accounts of Asia?
My essay shows that foods and foodways can offer an effective medium for racialization that essentialize ethnocultural differences into racialized attributes, as well as hierarchize those differences. Medieval Christian theological discourses on food and foodways bear witness to this mode of race thinking that demarcates hierarchies of foodways and by extension of different human bodies that practice those foodways. Looking into how food and foodways serve as racializing strategies can help us more closely examine this imbrication of culture and biology in race thinking. I specifically focus on what I call culinary Orientalism with the case study of the 13th century missionary accounts of Asia, specifically Mongols, in which these Franciscan missionaries wrote about their firsthand experiences of Mongolian food. They drink some fermented mare's milk. That's the key focus on my reading of these accounts. And one of the missionaries actually quite enjoyed drinking it. But he's warned by the local people that any local Christians would not dare drink that milk, because if you do so, no one would consider you as a truly faithful Christian. But he still wants to drink it. So the solution he finds is that the drink is fine. What's wrong is this primitive, uncivilized peoples that think that drinking this milk will make you not a Christian. That's not logical thinking. So there's this double-layered pleasure in culinary Orientalism here. One is the pleasure from enjoying this exotic delicacy, and another pleasure from marking Eastern foodways as inferior. I try to show that this Orientalist mode of race thinking has continued to modernity and informed later discourses on the relationship between food, foodways, body, and race, such as our contemporary myth about Chinese food as delicious, but as some sort of dirty. I wrote this essay partly as a response to the recent reemergence of the yellow peril panic witnessed in the early stage of COVID-19 outbreak. There was a return of familiar Orientalist ideas about Chinese food, such as a quick assumption Chinese wet markets and their culinary adventurism as a likely cause of the pandemic. A closer examination on how these rhetoric surrounding this yellow peril panic, and especially towards Asian food, help us further understand the complex operation of race thinking here. And looking into the medieval cases of similar attitudes toward Asian foodway can show that this actually has a much more deep root than we may think.
And last but certainly not least is Christina Ilko. Christina, could you talk to us about your article, Chess and Race in the Global Middle Ages?
So the basic idea is that medieval European representations of non-white people are usually perceived in two primary roles, limited to like negative, very subservient figures, such as slaves or executioners, or exotic status symbols like saints or wealthy rulers like Mansa Musa. But by focusing on the game of chess, my article casts light onto another kind of encounter in which people from different lands could engage in a sort of ludic contest as intellectual equals. My article has two key parts. So the first part explores the cosmological perspective by which the chessboard could encompass the whole world and the chess pieces, its peoples. A 12th century text by Omar Khayyam, a famous poet from Nishapur, describes mortal existence as a chessboard where destiny with man for pieces plays. There's another 13th century anonymous poem that also echoes very similar thoughts, which I would like to quote just very briefly. All the world is a chessboard, of which one square is white, but another black on account of the twofold state of life and death, of grace and sin. The pieces of this chessboard are the people of this world, who are drawn out of one bag like a mother's womb, and are positioned in various places of this world, and each one of them has a different name. So, very evocative texts like these really inspired my research. And through investigating this cosmological perspective, my article illuminates the racialized processes by which chessmen were constantly reinterpreted and reimagined. And it really investigates what these tell us about medieval perceptions of color and the human body. Now, then, the second part shifts the attention from the chess pieces to the chess players, ranging from European examples to Persian and Arabic manuscripts. It is really meant to explore diverse visual strategies through which chess contests facilitated cross-cultural and cross-racial interactions. And these range from very famous examples like the Libro del Ajedrez, the lavishly illuminated chess treatise of Alfonso de Wise, to little-known works. One of my favorite pieces was a Persian epic, the Shahnameh. And by drawing on the very diverse visual and textual representations of chess in these works, I argued that in this highly intellectualized war game, dark-skinned players were able to challenge and even triumph over the socially dominant personae with lighter skin by demonstrating intellectual prowess. I think chess was essentially a sort of imaginary space that did not eradicate preconceived social norms and hierarchies, but rather empowered the players to challenge them. Turning to another key point, I'm also interested in chess as a game of war. It prompted not only an occasion for social interaction, but also an active challenge between two players who each had an equal opportunity to win. This was a highly intellectualized contest in which the player with the superior strategic skill won, regardless of status, wealth, or skin color. I hope that one of the major interventions of my article is to offer a new model of medieval race thinking. Now, another theme in which this article hopefully contributes to is the global Middle Ages. And this is also connected to my current book project, which is provisionally entitled The Pawns of History, A New Approach Towards the Global Middle Ages. This book will focus on the game of chess and chess pieces as a very tangible approach towards the global medieval past. Scholars have often approached the multicultural Middle Ages either through its connectivity or as a period of barrier making and cultural difference. Chess, however, opens up a possibility to trace interconnectivity between different geographies, cultures, and social strata, but also show how the same connections could be used to create separation.
Thank you all for your work and for making the time to be here and talk with us. It's been a privilege to chat with all of you, and I'm excited about how this speculum-themed issue will push the field forward in new ways. That's all from me, Kate.
Many thanks to John, Cord, Ahir, FX, and all our contributing authors for that stimulating episode that adds texture to the issue, race, race thinking, and identity in the global Middle Ages. With your appetites now whetted, I encourage you all to read the articles in the journal. Let me thank the MMA series producers, William Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley. I'd also like to acknowledge the members of the Speculum Editorial Board, along with the Speculum staff, Taylor McCall, Carol Anderson, and Jane Mashew, and the Medieval Academy of America for its continued sponsorship. Music for the MMA is by Anna O'Connell. I'm Catherine Jansen, editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Speculum is the journal of the Medieval Academy of America and is published by the University of Chicago Press. One of the perks of joining the Medieval Academy is receiving both the print and digital editions of the journal. Online, you can find us at www.journals.uchicago.edu/talk/spc/current. Till next time.